Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
This is a Hat Trick podcast.
Oh, lovely.
Right, everyone, I just want to give you a heads up that the text we're talking about in this episode, well, it contains adult themes and, yeah, some explicit language. So, please listen to the episode before sharing with younger students or children to make sure that you're completely comfortable for them to listen. All right, buckle up, on with the show. Hi, Armand.
Hi, Jimmy.
So, this week, oh my God, I can't wait. What are you going to talk about this week?
We're going to talk about Aristophanes.
Ah, brilliant.
My favourite comic playwright. Brilliant, funny, hilarious, clever.
Troublemaker,
yep, that and all.
And what play are we going to kind of focus on?
Well, I think we'll focus on Lysistrata.
Yes.
Which is a wonderful play that was put on in 411 BC, yeah, when Athens and Sparta are in the middle of a prolonged war. So it's one of several plays in which Aristophanes presents a scenario in which characters say, look, it's time to make peace. Oh.
So what's the story of Lysistrata? What's the...
So here, what we have is that the women,
yeah,
of Greece, so starting with the woman herself who is Athenian, Lysistrata, but bringing together Spartans, Thebans, and other women to tell them, let us stage a sex strike,
right,
so that the men give up this ghastly war.
Right, so unless you give up the war, we're not going to have sex with you.
You're not going to have sex, yeah. The idea being that you're going to somehow force them into submission.
Yeah.
By depriving them of what they really want.
Yeah, and you can't go into battle with an erection on. So I suppose it's harder to run, isn't it?
So, yeah, I mean, these comic plays, you had the choruses with phalluses strapped onto their costumes. And so clearly what you have here is the opportunity for men to come on sort of stumbling with these extra large phalluses saying, oh, no, we can't bear it.
So what, they actually... So tell us loosely what the plot is.
Okay. So
there are some very funny scenes with her.
Yes, I mean, it's hilarious. So she gathers together the women and she says, this is what we're going to do. And actually, you know, the Greek view, the Athenian view, was that the women were just as keen on sex as men, if not more.
Yes.
And so you get some of the women saying, oh, we can't do that. We can't give up. You know, and she said, no, we've got to do this for the sake of Athens.
Right. So the women initially thinking, no, I don't want to give
this up. Yeah, a lot of them are saying, no, we can't.
But Lysistrata is quite a persuasive.
She's very persuasive. She's a really interesting character.
Strong woman.
She, very strong, strong-minded, clever, good orator. And she persuades them all to take the oath that they will withhold sexual favours from their men.
Right.
And then one of the main things they want to do is take over the Acropolis, because in the Acropolis, that
where the money is,
that's where the money was stored.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're saying that the war is only continuing because the men are in control of the money. We've got to get control of this, and that way they won't be able to prolong this war. So the old women, there's a sort of chorus of old women, and they storm the Acropolis. And then the men come along to try and burn it down.
Well, it's a chorus of old men and a chorus of old women.
Yes. So the men come along with their wood and so on. They say, no, we've got to get these women out. And the women have pitchers of water and they put the fire out and they swamp all the men. So there's a lot of comedy. I mean, this is slapstick stuff, clearly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the kind of the commissioner, the sort of
magistrate.
The chief magistrate, comes along and tries to lay the law down and say these women are behaving disgracefully. It's not the way women should behave. Of course, it's not the way women could behave in ancient Athens.
Yeah.
Then they tease him and they dress him up as a woman, say, you know, you want to know what it feels like to be a woman. And there's a little scene where you have an Athenian man called Kinesias.
Who comes on stage with a massive erection.
Yeah. And he says, oh, you know, I can't bear it, his wife.
So it's under his costume.
Don't know about under or outside.
Oh, outside. So the phallus will be outside.
They'd have hung them outside.
Right, so he wouldn't be tenting. He'd be actually outside.
Outside, fine. Yeah. Carrying this great thing in front of him and saying, you know, I can't bear it anymore.
Right.
And he's kind of teased by his wife, Mirene.
Yeah.
And Mirene kind of says, you know, oh, well, come on, my darling, and so on, and actually doesn't give him what he wants.
Well, she kind of prolongs. She says she agrees, gets the bed out, gets the thing.
That's
but
right.
In the end, she goes off to the Acropolis with the other women to look after
it's
money.
It's Aristophanes having fun with the idea that the women are teasing the men with their deprivation.
Yeah.
And then eventually the Spartan comes on in a similar state of desperation, and they make peace.
Mm.
They reconcile, and they all go off celebrating. So both sides have decided to make peace as a result of it.
What was the reaction to the play? Do we know?
No, unfortunately, we don't have any evidence for any kind of reaction on the whole to these ancient comedies or tragedies.
There were no kind of theatre reviews in those days.
No. In this case, there wasn't necessarily a strong appetite to end the war at this stage.
When did the war start?
It went on till 404, starting in 431.
So it's kind of gone on for a long time.
Gone on for 20 years, and it was to go on for another 10, roughly.
Oh, dear.
There were other things going on, of course. So shortly after this, there was what was called an oligarchic coup. So some elite Athenians took over the government, what was a democratic government. So the democratic Athenians, the Athenian demos, the people, were voting time and time again to continue this war.
Yeah.
So the aristocrats, the landowners, on the whole, it was not good for them because a lot of the war consisted of the Spartans invading Athenian land. And the war continued and the oligarchic coup was put down quite quickly. So initially 400 elite Athenians took over, and part of the reason was that the elites were the ones who were suffering most from the war, and they were the ones who ideally would have wanted to stop it. This is something that the average demos, average member of the demos of the people of Athens, wouldn't have suffered as much from. On the other hand, they were also fighting and going out to war and leaving their wives behind. But we are talking about a war which the Athenians were waging quite aggressively and keenly.
And that's because wasn't there a rather kind of charismatic demagogue at the time, Cleon? Wasn't he the warmonger?
He was a warmonger, but he was dead at this stage.
He was dead. Oh, so yeah, probably.
There were others.
He wasn't that effective at this point.
No. I mean, there was a chap called Cleophone, who was also a bit of demagogue.
Having just mentioned a demagogue, what was the function of a demagogue in ancient Athens?
Well, it just means a very popular politician, a bit of a sort of
a leader of the people.
Well, it literally means that, yes, a leader of the demos.
Yes.
So demos is one of those slightly ambiguous words, which can refer to the people as a whole or the common people,
right,
the Romans would have called the plebs.
Plebs, yeah.
And when you have a word demagogos in Greek, it means someone who is able to, you might say, almost a rabble rouser.
Mm. Yes, that's what, and certainly that's what we think of them as.
Yeah. So demagoguery is about appealing to base popular instincts in order to get political.
And because it was a direct democracy, they could change their minds of the demos day in, day out, couldn't they?
Yeah. And what you could have is a manipulation of the demos. So you might be an elite politician and your fellow elites want to, say, stop the war, but you appeal to the demos to vote for a continuation of it.
Oh, gosh, that's never happened in in my day.
No.
That didn't happen at all in 2016.
No. Well, there you go. You see, I mean, it's exactly the same thing that you have these people going, as it were, over the heads of the political class to the people.
And you hear it in Trump's, can I call it rhetoric? Well, in Trump's ramblings, you can hear that kind of notion of, I'm here for you guys.
Yeah, go direct to the people.
I'm a billionaire. I know what it's like to be you.
Yes.
You know? So within Athens at that time, were there different factions? Did Aristophanes know he was writing to a public that would be welcoming for this kind of idea?
It's possible, isn't it, that he was really talking to the average theatre-goer and that there were individuals who would have thought, what a good idea, you know, if we could just all reconcile. So the term Panhellenic, you know, we're all Greeks after all. On the other hand, it's also possible to see this purely as a fantasy, and to think about it as a kind of celebration of humour and sex, which is really what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Because the end of the play, it ends with the old men and the old women merging as a chorus, doesn't it?
Mm.
So they kind of come together and they're singing. And it feels very hopeful at the end. It's about, I mean, philosophically, isn't it also about, you know, can a society come together, acknowledge the differences, and live together in some kind of peace? Or will those very differences forever split them up and there'll always be conflict, there'll always be war? Which couldn't be a more contemporary issue, I don't think, because that's what we're still struggling with 2,500 years later.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, sometimes you have people in drama who kind of look down on the comedians. But comedy's much harder. And also, it enables us, and this play is a real example of it, it enables us to deal with really difficult subjects and entertain people at the same time, which is the best way of instructing anybody, I think.
Yes, and Aristophanes is in many ways quite a serious comedian. Mm. Some of the themes that he...
He'd be like the Armando Iannucci of his day, really, because I think those... It's the people who kind of get in the face of power,
yes.
You know? And he did, didn't he? I mean, this guy Cleon, that I'm very keen on, I'm very sad to hear that he died. didn't he try and sue Aristophanes after the Babylonians?
Yes, play? So much earlier on, 429...
When he was alive, so, yeah.
The way that the democratic system worked was that anybody could bring a lawsuit. And in this case, we're told that Cleon brought a lawsuit against Aristophanes, which could have resulted in being fined or even, you know, as far as exile, on the grounds that he had slandered the Athenians in front of non-Athenians. The reason that that was brought was that the play that he felt had done that was put on at one of the festivals called the Great Dionysia, where non-Athenians were allowed to attend. The Dionysia happened in early spring, March. The other Dionysiac festival took place in January. It was called the Linaia, and it was just for Athenians only because the waterways weren't open. It wasn't easy to sail to Athens in winter. So the fact is that you could have said all kinds of scurrilous things in front of the Athenians at the Linaia festival in January, which you were not really supposed to say in front of non-Athenians.
Yeah.
On the whole, the Athenians prided themselves on what they call paroressia, which is open speech, public speech. So they had the equivalent of that American.
Well, clearly, I mean, these plays, he will drop the names of real living people, usually quite powerful people, and really mock them.
Yes. So on the whole, we do get a lot of mockery of politicians. So he mocks Pericles, for example. But it has to be said that when he does so, Pericles is already dead.
Yeah, always very safe.
Always
speak ill of the dead.
And then there are quite a few minor politicians who regularly appear in Aristophanes' plays and are mocked for all sorts of reasons, some of them sexual, for example. But there's one character who surprisingly doesn't come in for a lot of explicit mockery, and that is Alcibiades, who's a very important politician of the period.
Okay, so this is the same Alcibiades that burst in to the symposium,
yes,
on another podcast that we cover.
Yeah, that's very politician, statesman, traitor, hero.
Protégé of
Socrates. But very important character in Athenian politics,
right,
of the period. And perhaps a bit surprising that he doesn't appear more explicitly in Aristophanes' comedies as someone who Aristophanes has a go at.
Could be mocked, yeah. Because he's often doing things which are extraordinary and provocative.
Yes, and he is a traitor to Athens at one stage, and he's a hero at another. And there are some theories that actually he does appear, but in sort of disguise, as other characters in Aristophanic comedies.
But I want to go back to the Lysistra, because I did a bit of digging around, because I was interested to know whether there'd been an uproar during its original performance, and we don't know that. But what I found quite interesting, and it's quite surprising, was in 1930, there was a Broadway production of Lysistrata, and there was a New York Society, this is a great title, the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice, lobbied to have police officers dotted around the theatre to ensure that censorship rules were being followed. Now, I'm assuming it's because of the scenes with people walking on with phalluses and sex scenes. And then it got worse. When it went to LA, a dozen police officers stormed the stage on the first night and arrested 53 cast members and then went looking for the playwright whose name was on the warrant. And the name was Arthur Aristophanes. I think that's one of the best facts I've ever read in my life. And of course, most recently, in 2016, apparently there was a comedy written by writer-director Matt Cooper. And he wrote a play based on Lysistrata called Is That a Gun in Your Pocket?
Right.
And it's about the women of Texas who go on a sex strike unless their men put their guns down. Actually, the most well-known iteration, I think it was 2015, Spike Lee's film, Chirac, transposes the events of Lysistrata to modern-day Chicago. And he substitutes the gun violence for the Peloponnesian War and rap dialogue for Greek poetry, and it's exactly the same story. Exactly the same story. So it's interesting, isn't it? That Aristophanes obviously hit a nerve because it's echoed down through the centuries, this notion that the deprivation of some, you know, conjugal right might change the game.
Yes, I mean, it would be interesting to know if women have ever thought that they might try and persuade American men to lay their guns aside by...
2012... Armand, a real woman called Isabella Amenganvi, she's a civil rights lawyer in Togo. She called upon the women of Togo to deny sexual relationships with their men in protest against the president. In 2012.
Togo?
Togo.
Togo, sorry, Togo.
Okay. Not Toga. Did I say Toga? Again, I'm doing a classics podcast, so I'm going
to...
I'm going to slip into a toga. So we're talking about Lysistrata, or Lysistrata, Lysistrata.
I have heard Michael Scott on television saying it in two separate ways, in fact three, I think, because we say Lysistrata in English, but the ancient Greek would have been Lysistrate, and the modern Greek is Lysistrata. So people say Lysistrata, Lysistrata,
yes.
Lysistrata. You can say it whatever way you like, but...
We don't know how it was intoned.
Well, we do know how it was intoned, but it's not the way we would say it. So in ancient Greek, you have what's called a pitch accent, and the voice goes up in pitch. In this particular case, on the penultimate syllable, so Lysistrate, your voice goes up on the A.
Lysistrate.
Lysistrate. But this then becomes a dynamic accent in modern Greek, Lysistrata. So you hear people saying Lysistrata, you hear people saying Lysistrata. I mean, English tends to have that, what's called a recessive accent. So we go, you know, Aristophanes, not Aristophanes, which is where the accent is. We say Lysistrata, not Lysistrata. That tends to be the English tradition.
Tomato, tomato. So obviously he's a comic playwright and the name is a coinage. What does it mean?
Yes, so it means literally disbander of army, someone who loosens the army.
Yeah.
So the lysis bit is as in a word analysis.
Yes.
Or dialysis, that lysis, the release or freeing or disbanding in the case of this. And stratos, as in strategy and so on, is army. So Lysistrate is disbander of armies, someone who does what Lysistrata is trying to do in this play, disband the armies.
So she's quite clever, isn't it? Because in terms of the economy of storytelling, she walks on stage and we all know what she's going to do.
Yeah. Just as when the Athenian man Kinesias comes on stage.
Yes.
The word kineo in Greek means the screw. So he's Mr. Screw.
Yeah.
So he comes on with his big phallus and you know what he's about.
He does what he says on the tin.
Yeah.
But, you know, the play itself, I mean... Part of our purpose in doing this is to talk about things of a classical nature and see where it resonates today. And this is just an obvious case, this play. It is a proto-feminist play, isn't it?
Well, it has been taken as a proto-feminist play.
Do you agree?
I don't think...
You're pulling your face like you don't agree.
No, I don't think Aristophanes actually intended us to think, you know what, women could do this sort of thing. Women could take over.
Oh, right. So he's thinking this is so ludicrous.
It's so ludicrous.
Oh, right.
So I sometimes make the comparison with Animal Farm.
Yes.
Where you have, you know, the animals taking over the farm.
Right.
And I suspect that in ancient Athens, the idea of women actually taking over and having real power would have been seen as similarly fantastic and ludicrous.
Yeah.
I'm afraid. I don't think it was... Look, women are really capable of that. I mean, in fact, Aristophanes writes another play called Women in the Assembly, where they take over the democratic assembly of Athens. But in the end, the play slightly fizzles out into comedy about how young and old women will get their sexual gratification. So it doesn't become a politically successful ending in the way that perhaps Lysistrata can be seen to be.
And that's because they don't like the way Euripides portrays them in his plays.
So that's another, yes, a third play called Women at the Thesmophoria.
Oh, sorry, that's a Thesmophoria Zeusa, isn't
it? Yeah, which is written in the same year.
Yeah.
And that's having a real go at his rival, the tragedian Euripides. So Aristophanes is always having a go at Euripides. And one of the reasons for that is Euripides' plays, his tragedies, very often incorporate a little bit of comedy.
Mm.
And Aristophanes is a bit annoyed by this.
Well, he kind of wrote banter, didn't he? He wrote Stichomythia, that kind of back and forth.
And things that you can almost laugh at, and ludicrous characters like Heracles in his Alcestis, who comes along and he's sort of a glutton.
So he didn't like Euripides?
Well, I mean, he was obsessed by Euripides.
Right.
As a comedian, it's like, this guy is writing tragedies which incorporate, you know, my...
jokes. Yeah,
yeah, my kind of thing. So yeah. I'm going to write comedies which incorporate some of his kind of thing.
But you know what struck me about the women in the Thesmophoria?
So that's a women's festival, the Thesmophoria.
Yes.
And in it, you get the tragedian Euripides being imprisoned by these women because of his... apparently misogynistic take.
I'm thinking about that play. I'm thinking about The Frogs, where...
So what you have in The Frogs is Dionysus, god of comedy, saying, I'm going to go down to Hades to fetch back one of our playwrights, because Aeschylus and Euripides are dead. But he wants to bring Euripides back. He says, I'm missing Euripides. Mm. Desperate for him, he says at the beginning of the play. Mm. Goes down to the underworld, and there the playwrights stage the contest... Agone, as it's called, a debate between these two playwrights, each of them in a comic way presenting how great their own work is and trying to show how bad their rival's work is. But of course, Aristophanes, as a comedian, is having a go at both of them.
Mm.
So Aeschylus might be old-fashioned, but he's bombastic, uses long words and so on. Euripides might be avant-garde, but then he's, you know, highly... disreputable when it comes to sex scenes, and the kind of music he introduces could be heard in whorehouses and things of that kind. So Aristophanes is standing apart as the comedian and poking fun at both of them. And the way the contest is actually framed is obviously comic. So you have these huge scales.
Yes.
And Aeschylus says, well, okay, well, let's weigh our words. And, you know, I'll put a great ship, the Argo, into...
because chariots.
Two chariots into the scales, and that'll weigh it down. And, you know, what has Euripides got to offer that is as weighty as that? And Aeschylus wins. Mm. So not the avant-garde Euripides, who Dionysus has gone down to fetch back, but the old-fashioned, much more patriotically-minded older playwright.
So Dionysus goes into Hades to decide whether to bring back from the dead Aeschylus or Euripides, the old ways or the new ways.
Yeah,
I mean, that does presuppose in the audience a fantastic background knowledge to all what would, you know, the arts. I mean, how smart are these average Athenians?
Well, I'm not sure it does. So you can watch a play, let's say it's a debate between Shakespeare and Harold Pinter.
Yeah.
Which of us is the better playwright? I think Sondheim did it with Shakespeare and Bernard Shaw, actually.
It's a good idea, yeah.
But in any case, you imagine that. Now, you may not know an awful lot about Shakespeare. You immediately recognise if there's a pastiche of a Shakespearean, you know, to be or not to be or something of that kind. You don't have to be deeply knowledgeable. But I think your average theatre-goer in Athens, it would have seen plays by Aeschylus, seen plays by Euripides, and they would recognise that... there's a certain style that goes with the older Aeschylean plots and characters, and, you know, Euripides is very different. And this is partly because that play is set in the beginning of 405 BC, when Athens really is at the crossroads. Will it win this war, or will it...
It's about to lose.
It's in fact, it's about to lose, and they weren't necessarily aware they were about to lose, but things are hanging in the balance at this point. And so the question is, do we bring Alcibiades back, who's been in exile, in order to help us win this war?
Mm.
And both the playwrights are asked that question, and both come up with ambiguous answers.
But that's also quite common, isn't it, in a modern psyche, the idea when you are confronted with a desperate situation in the present, there is a nostalgia, a kind of a yearning for the good old days. I mean, the whole Make America Great Again, you know, the whole Brexit thing was partly about, can we go back to a place that never existed? You know, when everything was great, because nothing is like that. If you think, let's go back, to the Victorian age? You know, so Aristophanes and Euripides were contemporaries, and you've got this kind of battle between, I mean, I can't believe we're going to talk about Drake again in a classic podcast, but apparently there is currently a battle, rap battle between Drake and Kendrick Lamar. And the idea is that one will issue a song saying, Drake will say, you know, Kendrick, you're not very good. Probably not in those words. And Kendrick will respond in like, in art form, with a, I mean, was there a kind of duality? Was Euripides allowed to have a go at Aristophanes? Aristophanes have a go at, because Aristophanes does have a go at Euripides consistently in his plays, doesn't he?
Yes.
Was Euripides having a go?
Euripides couldn't have a go back at Aristophanes, but he just did his own thing, which would be to include what we might consider to be light-hearted episodes within the tragedies. Aristophanes, being a comic playwright, was able explicitly
had more license,
to say, you're rubbish, and to parody him. But in tragedy, you can't do that. You don't break the fourth wall in tragedy. Tragedy is what we call a realist genre, so it may be at a consistent distance from the present, but it is consistent. Mm. This is what happened then. Unlike tragedy, comedy is an unrealist genre, so you can break the fourth wall. I mean, there's a wonderful bit in The Frogs, for example, when Dionysus is going down to the underworld and he says, you know, here we're going to see all the mother beaters and the rapists and the criminals. And then he looks up and he says, oh, yeah, I can see them all now.
Yeah.
So he's looking at the audience, he says it. So that sort of thing can only be done in comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
And similarly, you know, you can have a go at a real-life person, real-life rival, in the case of Aristophanes, you know, his rival Euripides, in a comedy. It's not going to be reciprocated in the tragedy.
And you mentioning then him, the actor who's playing Dionysus, breaks the fourth wall and looks at the audience. And we see that in modern theatre a lot. See it in the Commedia dell'arte. And you see it in some Renaissance things. You have an interlocutor, the Chase Made in Cheapside, as a character who talks to the audience all the time about saying, have you seen this person? Yes. Which actually doesn't go back to Greek comedy, does it? But Roman comedy set up those rules of those stock characters. There weren't any stock characters in Aristophanes.
Not really, though. Interestingly, in The Frogs, you have for the first time the character of the slave, the cheeky slave.
The cheeky slave, yeah, yeah.
Now, it's not so much
who's smarter
character.
Than his boss.
Yes.
And that is very much a stock character of Roman comedy.
It starts to become a stock character in what's then called Greek New Comedy, people like Menander and Discus in the 4th century BC as opposed to the 5th. And that is what's taken over into Roman comedy, Plautus and Terence, in the 2nd century BC.
Yeah, because there are those stock characters of the cuckolded husband, the lascivious wife, the wily slave,
the boastful soldier.
The boastful soldier. And in many ways, you know, these are the stock characters of lots of what used to be known as situation comedies. Mm. There is a stock nature to the characterization.
Sort of archetype, which was not the case with ancient comedy, which tends to be much freer and in a way much more inventive than that.
So each play he's creating almost like a new form.
Yes. Mm. And in fact, that's what makes comedy, according to one of the ancient comedians, Antiphanes. He says it's much harder than tragedy because tragedy provides you with characters and plots. Mm.
It's easy.
But comedy, you have to make them all up.
I agree with him. But then I would.
So that's a typical example of the sort of rivalry between the comedian and the tragedian.
Yeah, which has gone on for centuries, Armand, let me tell you. And it still goes on to this very day.
And Aristophanes is keen to say we comedians can also talk about important matters.
But I think that's what I've taken away from Lysistrata, is that what can be more important than the attempt to create a piece in a very how difficult it is to create peace in a warlike situation. And we are living through that as we speak, are we not?
All time.
It's All Greek and Latin to Me is presented by Armand Dangour and Jimmy Melville. The producer is Diggory Waite and the executive producer is Claire Broughton. It's All Greek and Latin to Me is a Hattrick podcast.
Hi, everyone. I just wanted to give a mention to Classics for All. Classics for All is a charity, and what we want to do is provide access to the classics to as many state school pupils as possible. Alongside training teachers who don't actually have to have any previous training in the subject, they hope that they make classics a sustainable part of the school curriculum. If you want to find out more about this fantastic charity, go to the website. It's www.classicsforall.org.uk.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.